One of the distinct privileges of being a pastor of the same church for a given length of time is that you get to see someone like Sharon, who was estranged from Christ and working through a lot of difficult kinds of things, address some of those tough issues and then start growing. And then we watched her fumble around in the wrong gift area for a while. And then we saw her find stride in the drama deal. And then you see her over the years be able to hone her gifts. There's a homemaker with two young children who has an enormous impact on my life and so many others. Greg Ferguson, who used to just sit out on Sunday morning, just sit right out in the crowd. And never thought he could make a difference. And it's just one of the great joys of ministry to develop the latent talent that God has put in our churches. Isn't that true? I mean, to just see people and to believe in people and to throw the challenge out, to throw the vision out to people and say, you know, you matter to God, you're important. It's not an accident that you're in this fellowship. You've got gifts. You really do. And if you'll just surrender them and let us work with you a little bit, we'll draw them out, and then you can experience the thrill of what it really means to be a player and not just sit in the grandstand. And I want to talk to you just a moment tonight before we get to the transferable concept idea. I want to talk to you about surviving leadership. And this is real fresh with me these days. Because as I've made reference a couple times in the last couple days, I came as close as I have ever come in 18 years of leadership to complete self-destruction just this past December, January, and February, and learned some very difficult lessons personally, and I've tried then to extend some of these hard-learned lessons to other leaders around the country because you know, I'm no different from anybody else, or you're no different from me on some basic kinds of things we need to understand. And so let me run through it as concisely as I can so we can still get to the transferable concepts. But an interesting thing happened as we headed into last fall. We added a second new community, as you know, which meant that from Labor Day on of this past year, I was teaching, Wednesday nights and turn right around and teach Thursday nights, lead and worship most of those times, and then Saturday nights and twice on Sundays, and a lot of other meetings and obligations and responsibilities, and wife and two kids that I, you know, really, that I take seriously and build into regularly. And I was doing pretty well, and I didn't know if I was going to be able to keep up that schedule, but I was sure going to give it a shot. And the elders were asking me all the time, how are you doing? And I said, it seems to me I'm doing fine. And I was doing pretty good. And then after Thanksgiving, I could start to feel myself going down on some kind of slide that I didn't quite understand. And as we were approaching December, I was having a harder and harder time putting messages together. And driving over to the church, I could feel myself starting to tighten up when I came in the entrance road there. And it sort of all culminated one afternoon when I was really struggling. I mean, I just flat could not put another message together. And it was right toward the end of this Fit to be Tied series. And, I mean, we had grown all... Fit to be Tied Up is what I was. But anyway, we had just added, another 1,000 people to the church throughout the course of the fall, and we were, we had momentum going, and I knew how important it was. And one particular Saturday, I was over here. I mean, I must have been here 8 or 9 hours, and I was stuck on about page 15. And I usually write, 30, 35, 40-page messages. I was stuck on page 15, and, I mean, it would not budge. And I'd write 5 pages and throw 6 away. Then I'd write you know, six or seven more and throw seven or eight. And I mean, I was going the other way. I was at page 10 about noon. And I said, this is terrible. And all of a sudden, I felt myself losing control and leaning over my desk, and I broke down bawling. And I remember saying to myself, this isn't right. I mean, I don't know exactly what's going on here. You know, this is not a good situation. Now, I got to pull myself together because I got to get this message done by hook or by crook. And if you can believe this, I had to do a wedding at 3 o'clock. And it was the kind where lots of people come to and all of that. So over in the chapel. And I hadn't given it 30 seconds thought. And so, I mean, I dried up my desk a little bit and I said, now I'm going to get back to whatever it was that caused that little crying spell there. I'm going to get back and think that through. But I can't do it now. And I started pounding and putting stuff down in that message. I wrote right up to 5 to 3 and went over and did a wedding with, I mean, I'm not kidding you. If you asked me who I married and what I said, I couldn't tell you. And I got done with that and I came back up and I pounded until 5 minutes to 6. And I came down, somehow made it through that weekend. And when I left the church after that Sunday, I said, I think we're near the end. So we're coming up to Christmas Eve now, and we're going to have, you know, 20, 25,000 people at these umpteen, I don't even know how many Christmas Eve services we had, but I had to speak at all of them. And so about Tuesday of Christmas week, I figured there's only one way that I'm going to get through this deal, and that is I'm going to have to go on a no-holds-barred fast for 5, 6 days. I need an infusion of spiritual strength that food ain't going to produce. So I went on a kamikaze, basically water-only fast, for I drank a couple of fruit juices over the course of about 6 days, but not much more than that, just a few times. And God gave me a message, and I went through 6, 7, I honestly don't remember how many. We had a whole bunch of those services, and then I thought, okay, we're done. I jumped on a plane with my family, went down to Florida, where we were going to spend 6 or 7 days vacationing. And the guy who's made our arrangements for us promised us that it was going to be a quiet getaway. And I got down there, and the hotel was 110% occupied. And I needed total isolation. And we got down there. It was like Grand Central Station in the lobby. And when we were on fourth or fifth floor or something, I pushed the button. It took 20 minutes for the elevator to come. And when it finally came, it was full. And I'm thinking terrible thoughts. Stuff they put you in jail for, you know. And so throughout the course of that stay down there, which was miserable because the place was crawling with people, I got up every morning and I went down and sat in a coffee shop down there, and I just said, what in the world is happening to me? And fortunately, and you know, I'm not a prophet of doom. I'm a real optimistic guy. But, you know, take it for what it's worth. Fortunately, I had learned the disciplines of self-analysis, the daily journaling deal. I had learned the discipline of connecting with God every day and the ability to discern the witness of the Holy Spirit. Fortunately, I had submitted myself to those disciplines for 5 or 6 years so that really in my time of greatest crisis, I had access to some of the tools that it would take to help me figure out what was going on in my life. And I'm just saying, some of you are coming to the end of your rope sooner or later, and you're going to get caught without the tools to do the work on yourself that it's going to take to figure out what's going on. But I knew that I had a total wheels-off wreck happening in my life, and I had to go all the way back and say, what's happening to me? And through the course of January and February, through a lot of, you know, introspection, self-analysis, and prayer, and some additional fasting, and through the counsel of guys from my accountability group and the elders and my wife and all that, I learned about what I'm going to talk to you about right now. I learned some tough lessons about gauges, gifts, and playing games. And we're going to run through it real quick. The first one is gauges. I I have made it a point the last 5 or 6 years of my life, since I've been real serious about all the disciplines, I have made it a point to keep looking at 2 gauges all the time to see how I'm doing in my leadership. And when I feel like God's not using me the way I wish He would, when I feel carnality sneaking into my system in ways that embarrass me, and when I'm not comfortable with what's going on in my life, I have learned over the course of the last 5 or 6 years to take a read on my spiritual gauge and see, is this thing reading full? Is it reading 3/4? Is it, you know, where's this gauge reading? And you know, a lot of people, a lot of Christian leaders wind up in the ditch because they get so busy doing stuff that they don't realize what's happening inside spiritually. They don't even, it's been so long since they've been connected to God in a real vital way that they don't realize that that spiritual health gauge is just going all the way down toward empty, and they're trying to do spiritual activity without spiritual energy. And so I've learned the hard way, you know, I cannot do the work of God without the power of God, and it takes the Spirit of God active in me to do the work of God. Now, that's a basic, and we all ought to understand that, and I have understood that the last 5 or 6 years. So whenever I feel any vibration, you know, in my life system as I'm going down the road, I do a quick read, and I've learned how to watch my spiritual gauge and read it, you know, very accurately. And if it's at a half or lower, I figure, man, I've got to do some more reading. I've got to meet with some believers who can fill me up spiritually. I've got to access different kinds of information that breathes spiritual life back into me, listen to some tapes or whatever. I know how that all works, and I hope and pray many of you become adept at reading that spiritual gauge. The other gauge that I've been getting better at reading is my physical gauge. And that is, I've learned sometimes that I can be doing really well spiritually, but all of a sudden I'll feel the vibration again in my life when I'm going down the road real fast. And it's very simple. I'm not getting enough rest, or I'm not getting enough exercise, or I'm eating wrong food, or cardiovascularly I'm letting up a little bit. And so the last 5 or 6 years I have been borderline brutal, you know, with the regimens that I place on myself physically. I'm one of these health food guys, bird seed, you know, the millet stuff, all the stuff that most people dread, and my wife makes sure of that, and I've, you know, pretty much submitted myself to that. I pump weights, I run, ride life cycles, you know, play basketball and do lots of physically demanding kinds of things. And the combination of this keeping my spiritual gauge at the 3/4 mark or over here, and keeping my physical gauge over at the 3/4 mark or full, has left me feeling virtually invincible. I mean, if you have the power of God in your life, and if you're healthy and strong, then there is no reason why you can't keep the pedal to the floor right from now till Jesus comes back. There's just no good reason. And so when we headed into the fall, the elders said, are you going to be able to handle these 5 services week in and week out? I said, I don't know. But I handled 4, and as long as, you know, the Thursday night message is just a repeat of the Wednesday night service, it basically is only going to take athletic energy for me to stand up and give it again. So we headed into the fall, and man, I kept reading these gauges, and I have to say something to you honestly, without pride. I'm pretty sure that there's not much pride in what I'm going to say to you now. You know, I want to be careful, because if I get struck, there's some of you pretty close to me here. But from Labor Day until Christmas Eve, unless I'm self-deceived, I don't think my spiritual gauge ever went below 3/4. It was one of the best 4-month periods of time I've ever known. Spiritually speaking, I have been close to Christ. I've been fasting and in solitude and feeding myself spiritually. And in the Old Testament, the New Testament, my accountability group's been saying, Bill, you're healthy spiritually. We can tell you walk with Christ. Physically, I've never worked out harder than I did from September through Christmas. Pushed a lot more weight than I'd ever been able to push. Ran further, jump rope, life cycle. Man, I was maniac. So when the wheels came off, when I start feeling them coming off, this was a flat-out mystery to me. And I said, I must be deceived. I must not be reading this gauge right. Or maybe, you know, someone put something in the bird seed. But something is terribly wrong. And I kept looking at one gauge in the next, one gauge in the next. Then I started saying, maybe God's calling me to another church. Maybe God's calling me back to the marketplace. I could not figure it out until after the fact. You know, when the wreck happened and I was a basket case and all that. I met with some people, a couple mentors and very bright people who said, Bill, you're missing a gauge. Right in the middle here. Who knows what it is? Yeah, the emotional gauge. The emotional gauge. What I had done mistakenly is I had kind of lumped my sense of how my emotions were doing. I'd kind of lumped that into my spiritual gauge. Felt that those two were sort of the same. Very costly error. Almost cost me my ministry. Those are two different animals. You see, I've learned the hard way that intensive ministry activity, IMA, intensive ministry activity, has the capacity to take a full emotional gauge and peg it on the empty mark in just a matter of hours. If you're in intensive ministry activities, if you're in these charged up counseling sessions, if you're having confrontations with leaders, if you're giving new messages and coming right up to the wire of giving them and not knowing how they're going to come out, and then afterwards, like I do, I meet 30, 40, 50 people, and the first guy says, my wife left me, and the second guy says, my son's on dope, and the third guy says, my mother just was diagnosed with cancer, and all of them want you to enter into their pain, and I'm standing there loving these people and entering into their pain as much as I can. In a single night, I have since learned, a full tank of emotional energy can peg out on empty. A single night. And the illustration that's helped me explain this concept to people is that if you go out to your car, many of you have rented cars here, if you go out to that rental car and you turn on every single accessory in the car, windows, lights, honk the horn, radio, get it all going, and then crank the starter but pull a couple plug wires, you can completely deplete the energy of that battery in probably 5 minutes. That thing will be completely drained. You know, massive energy drain. Now, if you turn the lights on for a while, then turn them off, if you did those accessories separately over the course, maybe the battery lasts a lot longer, but you have this massive energy drain, you can deplete it in 5 minutes. What I've learned is that a lot of what I do, and I wasn't in touch with this, but a lot of what I do involves massive emotional energy drain. It's just I haven't been aware of it. On a conscious level, I mean, my body and my emotions have been trying to send me signals, but I haven't been bright enough to catch on to them. And so a couple people helped me see what was happening to my life. And what's happening to my life is that I start on Monday morning in a fairly depleted condition from the weekend. So I start on Monday morning here and, you know, elders meeting and a lot of staff catch up things and working real hard on putting messages together. And so I start a slow drain down, okay? Maybe recover a little bit Tuesday, but then Wednesday I'm gearing up for new community and I do a new community. And I pour myself into my preaching and greet 30, 40 people afterwards. And I take a big hit on Wednesday and I go down, emotionally speaking. Now, spiritually, hey, lead a worship time and teach the Word of God. Does that hurt you spiritually? I mean, it's a great feeling to be used, isn't it? It doesn't hurt you at all spiritually. Physically, how demanding is it really, except for a few larynx chords? You know, how demanding is it to stand up in front of people and do what I'm doing right now? I mean, someone ought to be able, you know, most of our bodies are built, we could walk 5 miles tonight and, you know, it's a lot easier to do what I'm doing right now than it is to walk 5 miles. Most of us could do that at the drop of a hat. So Wednesdays, I'm doing fine, what I'm saying, in those conditions. Wednesdays, after Wednesday nights, I go down, and then I come in, start working real hard on the weekend, which is, you know, draining emotionally to try to put new messages together. But then Thursday night comes around, and then I go down further, because I do, you know, lead worship and preach Thursday night and greet people afterwards. So I come in on Friday morning, and I'm pretty low. I mean, that gauge is reading here. Now it's Friday morning. The very next night now, I'm due in front of several thousand people. So I'm down here, and I'm in this depleted condition, and I got to really pound my message out. Then Saturday comes, and I give a Saturday evening message, and I greet 30, 40, 50 people. Have an evaluation meeting afterwards. I come in on Sunday morning, and I do it two more times, 9 and 11, greet 30, 40 people after the 9, 30, 40 people after 11, and there I am. Okay? Now, the thing about batteries is that there's two ways you can charge a battery, a right way and a wrong way. The wrong way to charge a thoroughly depleted battery is one of these boost charges where you put, you know, this massive injection of power to a depleted battery, and if you do that kind of thing enough, it burns the plates out in the battery. What's the most effective way to charge a totally depleted battery? Trickle charge. How long does a trickle charge take? 8, 10, 12 hours. But it doesn't burn the plates out on the battery. Brings it up slowly to a full condition without damaging the internal aspects of the battery. But here I am, way down here, and I would like, I mean, ideally, I'd like to just get back up to the point where I started on the previous Monday. But from Sunday afternoon till Monday morning, there's not enough time for me to get back up to where I just started the previous week. So the next week, I start about here. See what's going to happen? And I follow the same diagonal down here, and the next week I start here, and the next week I start here, and pretty soon, I mean, I am in a complete state of emotional depletion at the beginning of a week where I got to go through it five times, and maybe an elders meeting and a few confrontations and some other train wrecks that happen administratively or so. So I'm running with this thing pegged on near empty, and I'm saying, no, something doesn't feel right, and there's a lot of funny things going on in my life, but how am I doing spiritually? Man, I'm doing great spiritually. How am I doing physically? Bench pressed more yesterday than I ever did in my life. I'm doing fine. But something is not right. Okay? What happens to people when they get in an emotionally depleted condition? First thing that happens is people get very vulnerable to sin. Because your defenses are down. I mean, one thing that happens, and I've checked this out with a lot of leaders across the country, you're vulnerable to sin. More specifically, when I say sin, you're particularly vulnerable to pleasure-producing sin. A lot of emotionally depleted people overeat. Why? Because it gives them a pleasure sensation. They don't know what's wrong, but they're emotionally depleted, and something inside of them says, I want to feel good. I don't feel good emotionally, but I'd like something to help me feel good. And some people then overeat or binge. Other people overspend. Other people start dabbling with pornography. Other people start winking at the waitress. I mean, you start escape fantasies. Now, I've checked this out by hindsight with five or six brothers that I know who have been key leaders, leading ministries, who have wound up in the ditch either through financial impropriety or sexual immorality. And you know what? This is proven out almost across the board. I've backtracked and actually called these people. So let me run something by you here. Just before you wound up in the ditch, how did you honestly feel you were doing spiritually? You know what almost all these guys told me? Bill, I might be crazy, but I'm telling you, I think I loved God as much as I ever had. But how were you doing physically? Well, you know, not bad. Just normal course of events. Wasn't sick or anything. Then I'd say, well, let me run by you what I learned about emotional depletion. And so these guys, I get halfway through it and they go, bingo. And a couple guys came right out and said, I found myself crying out for something cheap and superficial. And I couldn't figure out why. And I can relate to that because at the end of December, early part of January, I mean, I had this incredible craving for that which is cheap and superficial, so much so that it scared me. And I thought, I mean, these are thoughts of an unsaved man. But I know I love Jesus Christ. And I'm still reading the Word, and I'm still praying and connecting with God. Most of my time connecting with God, I'm saying, God, what's happening to me? And I was trusting Him and all that. Physically, I was still doing real good. I have learned that I have got to keep an eagle eye on that emotional gauge. And when that thing starts getting depleted, I have got to discern how much time and what kind of activities I need to involve myself in to do the trickle charge back to emotional health. Everybody is able to recover emotionally at a little different rate. Okay? Everyone recuperates at a little different rate. Now, my wife had a session, two-hour session with many of you gals today. When I went home after my last session, sat out on the back deck with Lynn, and she said, you know, I feel God used me. I wanted to go back and listen to your talk tonight, Bill. I can't. I mean, I am totally emotionally drained. Lynn won't be back to a full tank emotionally till probably Monday. And a lot of that's a function of her temperament and all the rest. But now for me, I'm not pretending like I'm totally healed up from this afternoon, but I had about 3 hours, and I played basketball with my son, and I worked out real hard, and I talked with Lynn out back for a while, and had a nice dinner, and I felt a little bit replenished emotionally, at least enough so that I'm not in a danger zone yet. And I did the kinds of things that I knew would start to replenish me. I didn't have enough time to get totally replenished. I mean, I'm about a third of a tank right now, to be frank. I'm reading right about here, as I can best discern. And it's going to be until after the weekend. It's going to be somewhere past the 11 o'clock hour on Sunday before I'm going to be able to really start doing the things that'll get me back up here where I need to be a healthy person. But again, I don't want to beat this to death other than to say all of you need to break that out as a separate gauge, read it very closely, and look for telltale signs of tip-offs that you're getting drained emotionally. Like if people start walking toward you and you say, I don't want another conversation. If you start getting tight in your stomach when it's time to do the next, if the phone rings and you get this reaction, if you find yourself craving the cheap and superficial, if you find yourself wanting to overeat, overspend, or indulge in some kind of illicit pleasure, don't lay a big trip on yourself and call yourself an evil person. It's probably more that you're a drained person, a depleted person. And once you get filled back up emotionally, you'd be amazed at how the temptations of the flesh just don't have near the allurement once you're healthy again. Isn't that true? Some of you relate to that? And then find out what are the activities that provide you with the best form of replenishment. For me, very simple. I wish it weren't true. I mean, I wish gardening did it for me. For me, it's ocean sailing. I ask God about that a lot, you know. But now God has provided. There's a man in the church that has a boat that he uses maybe 4 weeks a year, and it sits down in a harbor in the Caribbean, locked up, and he, you know, for 48 weeks a year. And he's given me a set of keys to it, and he said, please, anytime you can use it, it would just give me great joy if you would. And I said, it's a dirty, rotten job, but someone's got to do it. And so I'm embarrassed to admit this, and please, I guess I just have to ask you as friends, don't repeat this out of context. Please don't. But, I mean, I go down there twice a year. And it costs me $565 for a round-trip plane ticket. And we take food down with us, Lynn and I, and when the boat's free. But I wish I could just sit in a holodome in Peoria and get all, you know, replenished. You know, all my wife needs to do to get replenished is curl up by the fireplace with a good book. A couple of days of reading a good book and she's replenished. Me, I got to chase halfway, you know, to South America to sail to get my fix. But I might as well just own up and say, that's what does it for me. A bike ride doesn't do it for me. A novel doesn't do it. Gardening doesn't do it. Ocean sailing does it, and God's provided a way, and so I try to avail myself of that, and it serves me well. Watch those gauges and figure out how you can get them replenished, but don't think that you can do these massive recharges. You better do the trickle route, otherwise you'll burn your plates out. Okay, that's gauges. Next thing I learned will probably be even more pertinent to you. Gauges is the first thing I learned about. The second thing I learned is gifts, and this is probably going to surprise most of you. Most of you know, if you've learned something about network or if you've been around here at all, you know that we emphasize a lot around here that if you're using your top spiritual gift, most of us are multi-gifted. We have a top gift, a second gift, a third gift, whatever. But most of you know that if you're using your top spiritual gift, God sees to it that in the use of that gift, He breathes life back into you as you expend energy in the usage of that gift. Isn't that true? If someone has the top gift of evangelism and they're playing a round of golf in a foursome and they have an opportunity to share Christ throughout 18 holes, the guy comes home and he's flying, right? He says to his wife, "Forget what I shot. I talked about our Savior for the last 11 holes. It was wonderful." The guy can barely go to sleep that night. One of our elders has a gift of mercy. He goes over to a hospital, and if he can make 4 or 5 hospital calls, I mean, he gets his fix. I mean, he's whistling the rest of the day. These people, Greg and Sharon and these other people, they travel with me in various places around the world. If they can sing and act, I mean, the energy they get from doing what they love to do and what God's gifted them to do can transcend jet lag. I've seen it many times. Now, most of you also know that if you try to minister with gifts that you don't have, or if you try to use gifts that are down in your gift mix quite a ways, using gifts you don't have or that are far down the list tends to be a draining experience, right? I mean, you're uncomfortable with it. You have to prepare 10 times harder than other people would have to. You're nervous about whether or not it's going to come off. Afterwards, you're just so glad it's done with and you don't want to think about it. You dread the next time. All right. When God led me to start this church, oh, so many years ago, I did a very ruthless gift analysis of my gift mix. And here's how it looked. Top gift, I was clear about. My top gift is leadership, no question. Second gift, no question, evangelism. Third gift was the preaching, teaching gift. Now, I did a gift assessment like that just before we launched Willow Creek. And here I was, 23 years old, and I looked at that gift mix and I said, one thing's for sure. I better not be the primary teacher at Willow Creek Community Church. Because that's my third gift. And if I sign up to be the primary teacher at Willow Creek Community Church, I mean, I'm gonna wind up dead in about 3 years. It's going to wipe me out. I better concentrate on leadership and evangelism. I better find someone who can be the regular preacher and teacher. So I got on my Harley Davidson, and I went down to Dr. B's house, and I said, "Gil, this is the guy I want you to be the primary preacher teacher of the church." He said, "Will you give these Bible studies at Sun City, that youth group?" And all the kids responded. I said, "Gil, trust me. I've done it. I mean, I know who I am. It's third on the... I mean, I can't sustain an every Wednesday, every weekend deal. I just can't do it because it's third on my list. It's going to wipe me out." He said, well, I'll pray about it. A couple weeks later, after we set the launch date for the church, he said, no, he said, it's not me. I said, no problem, I'll find someone else. So I started working through a list of people who would be the primary teacher of Willow Creek. And while I'm going through all this list, the date's coming closer and closer. And pretty soon, I'm facing the fact that, well, maybe we're going to have to start out limping along with me being the primary teacher. So we start out, me being the primary teacher. Early in the early days of the church, I would speak on weekends, and I would put together mini devotionals for new communities. Because I couldn't do more than that. As hard as I worked, I couldn't crank out two messages a week. But I knew why I couldn't. Because this was my third gift. I was having a blast leading the church, and I was having a blast doing personal evangelism and corporate evangelism. This was beating me up, but I was only, you know, I said, I can only do a weekend service. New communities, I'll just patch together as well as I can. But over time, as the church grew, a lot of people start saying, you know what, we really affirm your preaching and teaching gifts. And the elders start saying to me, you know, we can tell you put a lot more work into that new community and it really paid off. So that sent a signal to me. What did the signal say? The signal said, if I work harder at it, maybe I'll do better at it. So I started working harder on Wednesdays and weekends. And working harder, and working harder. And so, here, you know, I'm doing more and more preaching and teaching, less evangelism and less leadership as time's going on. Now, there have been about five times throughout the course of the church where I have almost come apart at the seams. And every time, it was through emotional depletion and just to the point of almost ruin. And I always figured I was just overdoing something. This time, I mean, this past December and January, I hurt myself so badly that I said, I got to go back to the beginning. What's happened? Let's take a gift check. Guess what had happened over the course of time? Especially in the last 5 years, here's how my gift mix has looked in the last 5 years. Preaching and teaching, way up at the top, way down here would be a little bit of evangelism, and under that would be leadership. And if the truth were known, Don Cousins has led this church, and Nancy Beach, and a couple of other key people, they have used their leadership gifts in some remarkable ways. I mean, I almost abdicated the leadership of this church, not because I should have or wanted to, but because I'm spending 40 to 50 hours a week massacring myself to try to be able to preach and teach at the level that this church requires it. And I understood that I had slowly over the years done a complete flip of my gift. And here's an example of what happened where it really came home to me. I went on a speaking tour and I spoke at the kinds of places that most people would tell you if you're interested in this kind of thing. These are like places that would be a dream for a Christian speaker to speak at, you know, like the right conferences with the right, you know, emphasis under the right auspices and all that baloney. Well, in other words, what I'm saying is that I went on a speaking tour for a week. I think it was like 5 or 6 days. And like 2 or 3 speaking things each day, and some of them were different cities and all that, but it was, I mean, kind of one of these whirlwind things. We packed it off. On the way from one of the flights, one city to the next, they all run together now, but I sat next to a guy, and I had an opportunity to share Christ. I didn't lead him to Christ, but I'll tell you, I brought him right to heaven's gate, and I believe that he probably walked through sometime subsequent to that. But I got home, I walked in the door, Lynn said, how was your trip? And I heard myself say these words. It was fantastic. I sat next to a guy and we talked. I recounted the whole witnessing experience. She said, I mean, like, how was all the speaking? How was this conference? How was that? And how was that? And I looked at her and I said, as if to say, what does it matter? I could care less about that. I used an evangelism gift I haven't used in months. And I loved it. And it fired me up. And a sinner came right to the gates of heaven. And maybe a guy who's headed for hell is heaven bound now. And we get a grip. Do you realize how important that is? I thought about that later, and I said to myself, something's wrong. And I've now concluded that part of what contributed to the massive energy drain in my life was the flipping of my gift. I've been trying. I've been beating my teaching gifts to death. That's not so bad, but they're my third gift, and they drain me. So I put this all together in my head, and I went to the elders, and I said, I got bad news, I think. I said, here's who I am. Read it and weep. You know, I'm a leader, and I'm an evangelist, and way down here, I'm a preacher and teacher. And if I don't manage my life and ministry consistent with the gift mix and in the order that God wired me up, I'm going to wind up in a ditch. And I love God, and I love you people, and I love the Church of Jesus Christ too much to wind up in a ditch. And I felt this, you know, I mean, I started, since January and February, I started reactivating my leadership gifts. I love using my leadership gifts. I love to strategize. I love to vision cast. I love brick walls that just stare you right in the face and people say, well, you're never going to get around this one. I love that stuff. I love it when Pat, my assistant, says to me, you know, I know you only have 8 minutes before your next deal, but we've got about 6 decisions we have to make. That's like recreation for me. I say, oh, walk with me, Pat. Walk with me. And don't give them to me fast. Give them to me slow so I get a little chance to enjoy every one of them. See? I mean, I love board meetings. And I like it when some of the figures don't look good, because then it just elongates the pleasure of trying to crack the code of what it means, what decisions we're going to have to make. And I was telling a brother the other day, when I need a break, when I'm doing message preparation, when I need a break and feel like I got to go get my head cleaned out, I don't go down to the elder's office. I go to the planning and development department or the finance department, because those are the guys that, you know, need a lot of leadership, because a lot of decisions need to be made. And I go in there for recreation. I love using my leadership gifts. And I've told the elders, the board, and the whole leadership core of this church that this is who God made me to be. I knew it 18 years ago. I lost sight of it. My fault. No one else's fault but mine. My fault. But this is who I am, and this is how I have to slant my ministry throughout the rest of its course. Secondly, I'm an evangelist. I love sharing Christ. I don't have to do it from a pulpit. I love sharing Christ wherever you can find me a speaker who's willing to hear me talk to him about it. I love it. I'm not a whole person unless I have an opportunity to be in the face of a seeker and talk to him about Jesus. It's who I am. It's what I love to do. And I'm going to be doing more of it, mostly in private settings. I want to kidnap 4 or 5 real hardball non-church guys, and I want to take them sailing, or I want to take them golfing, and I want to say, now, what are you doing with your life that really matters? And the tougher they are, that's okay. I mean, I like that stuff. I'm willing to continue to preach and teach, but only at the level that God has gifted me to be able to do it sanely. And some of you might have learned that as of about March, we've taken a turn in the church, and we have started a team teaching approach here that I am excited about beyond words for many reasons. First of all, for self-survival. But beyond that, I think, you know, Willow Creek is known worldwide for doing everything in teams. And we're putting together a teaching team now, a rotation, where myself and a few other brothers are going to just, we're going to figure out what our strengths are in teaching and figure out a way that we can bring strong teaching to the body of Christ, and the people of this church are going to hear the voice of God through different voices of men, which is a healthier thing than for people to hear the voice of God only through one man. And we're going to try to blow out of the water the whole idea that a mega church is a one-man show. And I'm going to use my leadership gift to try to build a teaching team and lead and mentor and assign strategically these teachers in a rotation where I think not only will the church be better served, but it will also be a model of what I call the succession crisis, which is what happens to Willow Creek after Hybels kicks off or falls in the ditch. And if we have a strong teaching team, the teaching team just continues right on, and people with leadership gifts lead, and the church can go on, and it's not all predicated on one guy. And so I'm hoping that we can be a model, not just of a lot of the other kinds of things that we're trying to do, but we can be a model of a team teaching approach. And it's risky, but it's a challenge, and I get to use my leadership gifts while we try to crack the code, see? So I'm all fired up about that. Now, just here's where the application goes as far as you're concerned. Some of you find your emotional gauges on empty on a regular basis, and you don't know why. And I want to challenge you to do a ruthless gift analysis and figure out the sequence and honestly say to yourself, the top gift that I have, if I use it, probably breathes life into me, doesn't drain me. Second gift is probably a split. Little drain, little input, might even out. You get below the second gift, and my guess is it's more of a drain than an input. And you look at how your actual time is spent in your weekly schedule. And you better start ministering consistent with the gift mix that God's put in your life, or you're going to find yourself pegged on empty emotionally. And you're going to cry out for something cheap and superficial. Insurance business is going to look real good to you. Huh? And it might only be because you've got these things flipped around. Okay? Now, quickly, the last one. Gauges gifts and playing games. I'll try to make this brief. I did a check of the relationship between the mundane and the eternal in my life. When I started in ministry, 1973 or so, I had a lot of what I call the mundane in my life. A lot of recreation, a lot of diversions. I raced motorcycles, Corvettes. I have a pilot's license. I sail, windsurf, racquetball, baseball, you know, a lot of these kinds of deals. I didn't, you know, do all of them every week, but I had, you know, a lot of things going on. Now, interestingly, as the time in ministry proceeded, my mundane chart started at an all-time high in 73, went like this. Until 1989, the only time I had any mundane in my life was on vacation. If I was not on vacation, I was flat out preoccupied from before dawn until I crashed at night with matters of the eternal. And I think in Scripture, there was a built-in advantage to being a minister in the first century A.D. This is a little wild hair idea, and you don't have to buy it if you don't want, I understand. But I have a little theory that it was easier to be a minister in the first century than it is in the 20th century, particularly the last part of it here. Because, see, you had a built-in mundane factor in the first century. Explain what I mean. Jesus gives this exhausting Sermon on the Mount, right? Or he gives a full discourse somewhere, and then you read in the Bible, then he and his disciples walked down to Jericho. Okay? How far is it from Jerusalem to Jericho? 15 miles, 17 miles, something like that? I mean, I've been there, but I forget the exact. Is that close enough? 15, 17 miles, something like that. That's a long walk. And so, you know, they're walking at, let's say, 3 or 4 miles an hour. And they're stopping along the way at the well, and they're chewing the fat at the well, and they're, you know, having a little drink, throwing water around and this kind of thing. And then they go further, and then they're going to stop for lunch. Well, they stop for lunch, they got to build a fire, so they walk around, collect a little wood, and someone has to build a fire. And then they got to find some food, and they got to cook it, and then it takes a while for the coals to get just right, and they do all this, and they're just kicking back while all this is happening. And then they got to clean up afterwards, and they make the next part of the thing. They get down there about nightfall, they got to cook dinner, and all that. To see what's happening, there's just a built-in slow-down factor because of the way the society works and the way you went about making life happen regularly. Run the clock ahead now. I mean, I go home between work and having to come back for new community, and I put something in the microwave, and I say, these things take forever, right? And I got a phone in my car, you know, fax machines, it's amazing how much ministry you can cram into a day now that we have jets and faxes and phones in cars and all the toys. I mean, I don't have time to tell you some of the stories, but someone will find out that I'm going to speak in L.A., and they'll say, well, on the way out, can you stop here? Well, I suppose I could stop there. You know, well, while you're over here, could you just ride with us and go over there? Well, I suppose I could. I could fit it in, you know, all like that. I wind up, you know, it's physically possible for me to do it. And spiritually, I'm strong. It's just that you deplete yourself in these massive energy drains if you don't have enough mundane cushions between intensive ministry activities. It's the mundane that works as a buffer in your life. It's the mundane that helps your trickle charger bring you back up to full strength. And in modern-day church work, I'm telling you, man, it is a setup for self-destruction. Now I'm convinced of it. I wasn't 6 months ago, but I am now. Modern-day church work is a setup for self-destruction. Because you really don't have to have any mundane time anymore. I mean, things whiz in and out to you, instant communication, jet travel, fast. You can just do ministry in massive doses and have massive drains and not even know what's happening. So, it's time for me, and I've started since January, to turn that thing around and go back up. I should tell a story that, I mean, at the absolute pit of my breakdown, whatever you want to call it. There's a non-church guy I've been trying to lead to Christ for 10 years. I don't think I've made a dent. Okay? Good friend, though. He heard through the grapevine that my wheels had come off, and he was very concerned. So he calls me, and he, I can't tell you the exact language he used. He's a very profane man. But he said, so you got yourself all blanked up, huh? Messed up. And I'm on the phone, you know, just barely conscious. And I said, well, that's one way of putting it, I guess, you know. And he said, listen. He said, I got to take care of you, kid. He says, you know my place out west? Go out and use it. And I said, you know, it's amazing that you say that because I have a commitment out in L.A. that I cannot miss, even though I'm comatose. I've got to do this thing because it's been committed for a year. And I was looking for a place out there that I could crash afterwards. Lynn said I could crash for 3 or 4 days. She knows I'm in big trouble. And he says, crash at my place. He's got a real nice place just outside of Palm Springs. So, I mean, and it's the dead of winter here, and I'm like a solar-operated person. I am. So, I get out there. That just came off the top of my head right there. You want to... Probably going to hear that in sermons around your places. All right. But anyway, you're going to tell your elder board you are too, right? So I get out there, and before I leave to go out there, I call a couple of my mentors, and I say, I'm spending 4 days at a place. It's a hideaway. No one's going to know me out there. how do you think I ought to use the time? And one guy that I really trust, he said, man, just bring monk books. You know what I'm saying? You know, the old classics, the Genesee Diary stuff and all, you know, all this kind of, bring monk books and just bury yourself in them. Sounds good to me, man. I don't know which way is up right now. I'll take any counsel you give me. I load up with monk books. I go out and I do my speaking thing. I do my speaking thing, rent a car, come over and collapse in this guy's place. And no kidding. I mean, I didn't even go in the bedroom. I just crashed right on the couch in the living room of this place, and I got all these monk books, and I'm reading these monk books, and I'm crying, and I'm praying, and I'm rolling over on the floor with my face down, saying, oh, God, what's the matter with me, you know? And I'm going, and then I do a little reality check. How am I doing? Is this helping at all, you know? And as I do this check, I'm going lower. I'm heading down. And I say, more monk stuff, bring it on, you know, more monk stuff. And these guys are talking about hating the flesh and poverty vows and all this stuff. I'm on, you know, take my shirt, God, take anything, you know. And I'm on the floor, and I'm going lower and lower, and I'm saying, it's okay, it's all right, I just trust you, God, I trust you. And then the second day of this, there's a knock on the door in the middle of one of these monk fit things that I'm throwing. I'm laying face down, there's a knock on the door, and I'm saying, if that's someone who knows me, I'm going to kill myself. I walk to the door, and it's the guy who owns the place. He says, yeah, kid, I was worried about you, and I figured I had to come out and take care of you before you did something stupid. I'm looking at this guy like I've seen a ghost. I mean, I'm standing there, I'm saying to myself, this can't be happening to me. What am I going to do? I got to read monk stuff. I mean, this... The only human being who could have a ministry to me right now is Mother Teresa. I mean, I need somebody of incredible depth and insight. And this guy's looking at me, and then it crosses my mind, I can't shut the guy out. He owns this place. And I don't have enough money to go to a hotel. And I'm just saying, God, this is straight from Satan. This is demonic. So he kind of pushes me out of the way and he says, you golf yet? This place is on a golf course. Golf? I haven't been up off the floor in 2 days. He says, come on, get your stuff. This place is a mess, he says. Come on, get your stuff. We're going to go golfing. I followed him, you know, he's just like this. And we go down, and to make an overly long story, much, you know, to try to crispen it up, for the next 2 days, this guy dragged me around and immersed me in the absolute mundane part of life. We golfed ourselves into oblivion. And between games, you know, we'd go in the jacuzzi and he'd say, do you ever have a massage? I said, no. Feel very uneasy about people doing that. New like that. He said, you haven't lived until whatever her name was. Some big German babe, you know, big biceps on her there. She about killed me. And before she's something, you know. Yeah, I'll bet. But and then we'd go there and he'd say, he's got a fascination with airplanes too. He says, I'm thinking about buying a plane. Let's go look at a couple planes, you know, and then we go do that. He says, I'm not thinking about buying a golf course over here. Let's go over to do that. So we'd go here and there and have meals and he'd say, you know, we need to go here. And so anyway, after 2 days, then I gather up my monk stuff. He's going to stay there, and I got to come back. On the plane on the way back, I do another check in my journaling. I'm sitting on this plane coming back from Palm Springs, like 8 o'clock in the morning. I get out my journal. I say, now, what's going on in my life? And I said, I think I'm getting better. God, I'm getting better. I'm healing up. And I can't believe who you fingered to bring me to this point of healing. I mean, I've heard you using some pretty unlikely characters before. But this man was an angel from God telling me that I need more mundane in my life. I've got to mix up the eternal with the mundane so I can keep the wheels on better and I can trickle charge myself back with more regularity. And that was a lesson well worth the time, right? And so I've been building more mundane matters into my life since March. And I've been going to the driving range and hitting balls out on the highway and that kind of stuff. And if you saw that 20-year-old car out in the parking lot, I had a Pontiac GTO when I was a kid. Had to sell it because I got broke in college. And for about the last 8-9 years, I've been saying, if I ever found a 1970 GTO, I might just buy it. But I'm Dutch, I'm frugal, I hate to spend money and stuff like that. But I went out and I bought one of those things, 20 years old, 101,000 miles on it. I didn't even pay that much money for it. But is it a kick? I mean, it is. It just gives me a buzz. And so, I mean, I need a few buzzes in my life. And I got my Harley running again. I listened to it in the garage before I came over here. I mean, I didn't get to ride it, but I just listened to it. And if you know, if you know how a Harley sounds, it's just like a little shot of adrenaline, just listening to a Harley. And I might even get back into a little, this summer, I'm going to one of these racing schools, like Paul Newman got in these driving racing schools. I used to race cars on tracks, and so I'm going to take a professional racing course, and so, and I'm going to integrate the mundane back into my life and stay healthy for a while, okay? And I am increasing my desire to be a difference maker as the pastor of this church over the long haul. I mean, I can start looking forward to the future now and say, I think I like it. And I think I want to keep going. And I think I not only want to just maybe have started well, but maybe I even want to finish well. And I am jealous for every one of you. I really am. I don't know you that well. I don't know most of you at all. But I have an enormous amount of respect for people who have thrown their lives into kingdom work. And I have an enormous amount of respect for every one of you who get up day in and day out and just go after kingdom gain and pay the price to follow Christ and to lead a church and to endure all the disappointments along the way, take all the shots you take, and get, by the world's standards, very few rewards for doing it, but a lot of grief from people who want more out of you. I have an enormous respect for you, and I'm not too proud to plead with you. Watch this stage and be a truth teller about what it's reading. Figure out how much time it's going to take to trickle charge yourself back up to wholeness. Do this gift thing. And don't lie to yourself, because you're curtailing and possibly jeopardizing your ministry if you don't work in the sequence that God has given you to work with. Keep the mundane in your life. Don't apologize for golfing. Don't apologize for driving something fun. Don't apologize for having, you know, recreation and leisure, the kinds of things that breathe life back into you. Because Paul was able to say, I have fought the good fight, right? I have finished the course. I've kept the faith. And he lasted and finished well. I told some of you, Lynn and I had the opportunity to spend a day with Billy and Ruth Graham. And I'm looking at this man, he's what, 73 years old now, and on the ropes physically. I mean, he's really had a hard time if you are praying people. You know, he had his, recently was in surgery at Mayo Clinic, and he's, you know, pretty serious. But, you know, I'm looking across the room at this guy who has been faithful for 45 years. And he's fresh spiritually and emotionally, physically, you know, he's getting older. But before we got up to leave, tried to leave about 5 times. No, stay, I'm enjoying this fellowship. But get up to leave, and I mean, I'm just going to bust out this time because I know he needs to sleep. And he takes his Bible and he says, feed me, Bill. Read the Word to me. Feed me. No. I want to be that way when I'm 73. I want to have a love for the Word when I'm 73. I want to have a clean track record when I'm 73. I want to have my family around me when I'm 73. I mean, I want to still have vitality in my spirit when I'm 73. And I'll tell you, the way I was living my life, I would make it to 43. And the way some of you are leading your lives, you're not going to make it another 2, 3, 4, 5 years either. And we don't need any more men and women in ditches. We need them on the center line. Emotionally healthy, working with their gifts, right next to the mundane, so you're fresh and useful for the kingdom of God, for the long haul. Now, I have to apologize to you. I was going to try to do this and the 10 transferable concepts. Well, 1 out of 2 ain't bad, huh? Very embarrassing, friends. Okay, that's enough. Please. That violates my conscience here. I'm probably going to get shot from making this commitment to you, but I think we have your names and addresses. And I was basically going to give pretty much the same kind of talk that I gave at the February Pastors Conference with the 10 transferable concepts. Would you be open if we sent you a complimentary, a tape of the talk that I was supposed to give? Would that be all right? Okay. And we'll do it that way, and I'll take the heat. It's not a big problem. I was supposed to tell you, I'll use my leadership gifts. It'll be all right. I was supposed to tell you a couple things before we close. First, did Bruce talk to you about our internship program? If he did, I just want to say, if some of you are feeling led by God for a time to get retooled, because you feel like God's leading you to a different kind of ministry, and maybe a year service around in this environment would help you recalibrate for a different kind of ministry. We're open to talking to you about that, and Bruce is the one to write and confer with about that later. Second, I'm supposed to tell you that the sessions begin tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m., and there's no breakfast before. And just be here or be there or be square, I always say it. And I guess the last thing I wanted to say was every pastor's conference that we have has kind of a different personality to it. And from my standpoint, this has been a very joy-filled conference for me. Your spirit and attentiveness and eagerness to grow and learn, your honesty in the questions you've asked, and just the way I talked to the staff earlier, and they said there has been cooperation from you across the board. And I don't know, I mean, chances are pretty high we're never going to be gathered like this, this side of heaven. And one of the frustrations of these kinds of deals is I'd like to take a long walk with every one of you to find out how you're wired up and how God's working in your life. But we're going to have a lot of time in eternity to reconvene and have all of you stand up. And, you know, that's one thing that really makes me look forward to heaven, is finally we'll have enough time for the kinds of fellowship most of us yearn for, but, you know, don't get around to very often. But you have been a delight. It has been easy for me to serve you. And I hope that if this conference was meaningful to you, that if you have other people you'd like to bring back and bring through it, you know, we always welcome people to come back. We try to keep the cost down so that you can come back often and not have it break the bank. But I'm just trusting that something you will have gleaned here will serve you well when you go back. Now let's pray. Lord, yesterday morning we started this conference, seems like a long time ago, but we started this conference saying, Lord, surprise us, minister to us, here we are, wholly available, open us up and touch us, point out the weak spots, underline the strong spots, give us new visions, give us a new enthusiasm for being a part of building an impact church against which the gates of hell will not prevail. And Lord, I think you've answered the prayers of many of us. And lots of us have been touched. Lots of us have been healed up. Lots of us have discovered some new relationships and some new visions and callings and passions. We've gleaned some ideas from each other. And Lord, as the conference continues tomorrow morning, I pray that you'll anoint Jim Dethmer and Jim Nicodeme as they teach us. I pray that you'll allow me to finish the message so that I can minister to the speakers over the weekend. But Lord, we love being in your work. We love being in the trenches. We love knowing every day that we're making differences that count for eternity. And we love the church. We know why you called it your bride. And Lord, together we devote ourselves to long-term, effective leadership in your church. And we're going to trust you to be the companion and faithful friend showering upon us irrational love every step along the way. We pray this with thanksgiving in Jesus' name. Amen.